Accession number 4550, Reel 4.
General Breeden, Reel 4. What was your opinion of General Montgomery as he was then, General Breeden?
Well, my opinion is probably coloured by the fact that when I first met him, I was a very junior second lieutenant. And to us, he was absolutely God. And the reason why we regarded him like this was that he actually took notice of us. And he listened to our views. In fact, he asked us for our views. He talked to us not as a very senior officer, but as a keen soldier in pursuit of the facts, and who wanted to hear everybody's views. He spent a very great deal of his time not in his headquarters in Haifa or in his office, but in going round the various detachments and units of the army, talking to everybody as much as he possibly could. Another thing he did was his ADC would most Saturdays try and collect half a dozen young officers who happened to be on leave in Haifa or something like that, and bring them to have supper with Monty. And there they would go, Monty and these half dozen subalterns, just sitting around a table. We'd have supper. I was lucky enough to do this two or three times. And then after that, we all went to the cinema with Monty. And he would start the ball rolling. Naturally, we usually felt a little bit apprehensive to begin with, talking to the divisional commander. He'd start the ball rolling by saying to one of us, what do you think of the Arabs? And when the person had given his view, Monty would say to one of the others, do you agree with him? And then he'd change and ask somebody else what their opinion was. And he'd then ask them what they thought of the Jews, or the standard of our weapons, or what sort of a country Palestine was, the standard of the rations, anything which had an impact on the military situation. And we regarded him as a jolly good sort of stepfather almost in Cyprus. And furthermore, we realized that he had studied his profession. You could see that absolutely oozing out of him. And indeed, one of the things that no soldier who ever heard this forgot was that when he came to talk to my regiment just before we left Palestine, in his speech he said to us, he said, and when you get home, have a jolly good leave. Now this was in April 1939. He said, have a jolly good leave. And he said, immediately you finish your leave, get down to it very quickly, learning as quick as possible and as efficiently as possible how to fight Germans. And he said, you won't have much time. And so naturally, we took some notice of what he said. But to those of my age group, most of us were passionately pro-Monty. I do realize that Monty was in many ways a vain man. He had a great deal to be vain about. He was, whatever you say about him, he succeeded. And I think this is one of the troubles, that a lot of the people who criticized Monty were rather resentful of the fact that he succeeded. I think you'll find that quite a number of the people who criticized Monty were probably sacked by Monty for very good reason too. But there were a number of senior officers who, for one reason or another, they were either jealous of Monty, or they didn't like his ideas, or perhaps they realized that Monty didn't like them. But I had occasion in during the war to see some of the results of Monty going round and talking to the soldiers. And I remember one time in Tunisia, he came and talked to three different battalions, and I was present on each occasion. And those three battalions had formed part of First Army, and they knew nothing about Monty. And they were all suspicious of him. They thought to themselves, who's this funny chap with a black beret who opens his mouth rather loud and who has had a nice easy time coming from Alamein to Tunisia? But Monty, having talked to them, that same crowd cheered him out of sight and never said a rude word about him again. And I think it has been misrepresented in many instances, and I particularly, I'm afraid, I'm thinking to myself of a book by Lord Chalfont about Monty, which I think is very far from the truth in many ways. It damns him with faint praise. And whether we like it or not, to my mind, he was a great man who, like most great men, had failings.
How did you come to join one of the special night squads of Ord Wingate?
Well, one day I was minding my own business, commanding my own platoon in my battalion, when the commanding officer sent for me and he said, I've got a special job for you. And he said, I don't know what it is, I'm not allowed to tell you, but he said, you will be away from the battalion for quite a long time, so you better take a month's rations with you. And he said, I don't know when we'll see you back here, but you can get in touch with me later and tell me, well, what it's like. And here is a map reference in northern Palestine. At that time we were stationed in Nathania, which was about 70 or 80 miles to the south. And he said, right, get going, and the only information I have for you is that at that map reference you will meet somebody at 5 o'clock in the evening who will tell you what to do and where to go. And that's the only briefing I got. So I took my platoon complete with rations and ammunition and all the things that one knew one had to have with one if you were going to be away for a bit. And we had we had two trucks of our own, and I think we had one other hired lorry which we released after we'd finished with it. And off we went, and the map reference was quite near a Jewish kibbutz called Ein Harad in the valley of Jezreel, halfway between Afule and Beisan. And we got to this place. We got there early, half an hour or an hour before the time that I mentioned. And when we stopped, a rather untidy looking officer came out from behind a hedge and said, you're late. All right, follow behind my car. And that was my first meeting with Captain Ord Wingate, who, as I later found out, was running an organization called the Special Night Squads. And what he had done was, without going into all the history of it, which is written very well in other places, he had organized three squads which were to try to combat the Arab guerrilla activities, firstly along the Jordan Valley, and secondly in sabotaging the oil pipeline which ran across the hills to the north of Ein Harad. Now, he had these three squads located, one in Ein Harad, which is where he had his own headquarters, and the other two in villages in the Jordan Valley. And I discovered that there were two other platoons, like my own, which had been extracted from their regiments. One from the Manchester Regiment, commanded by a chap called King Clark, Rex King Clark, and the other one from the Royal West Kent Regiment, commanded by Mike Groves, both of whom became great friends of mine. And so Wingate led us in his ancient Studebaker car to the Jewish settlement of Ein Harod and handed us over to one of the Jews who ran the settlement, and we discovered that he had organized dormitories for us and that we were going to eat in the Jewish dining hall with the Jews. In fact, we needn't have brought our rations at all with us, but we kept them just the same. And when we got there also, he said, well, you better have a meal quickly because you're going out in about 2 hours' time. And we didn't know what he was talking about. But he then, we having had the meal, he gave us a very rapid briefing and said, right, I'm going to teach you how to move by night. And he made various alterations to what we carried, such as he said, right, no hats will be worn, and you will all wear gym shoes. Incidentally, gym shoes had been a thing that we had been all told to bring with us. And in fact, what he was doing was he simply took us out and took us on a bit of a sort of 4 or 5 mile wander around the countryside just to see how well we could move by night. And that was our first taste of what he wished of us. Now, the situation in Ein Harod or near it was that every now and then Ein Harod itself, and indeed all the other Jewish settlements down in the valley there, used to get sniped perhaps once or twice a week. But the particular thing that he was after was to catch the Arab saboteurs who used to dig up the oil pipeline, shoot holes in it, and then set fire to the escaping oil, which used to shoot up to 80 or 100 feet. And so when this was set on fire, you could see the fire over half of Palestine. You could see it for 70 or 80 miles. So he gave us these first lessons, and then during the days that followed, when we recovered from our intense surprise and settled down, he gave us instruction in how he thought that night squads should move, how we should communicate with each other, rules about silence, rules about drinking and not drinking, how we should fit in with the Jews, because we had in the settlement a number of Jewish supernumerary police who were also organized into squads by Wingate. And when we went out eventually, we normally had a mixed squad of British and Jews. And amongst these original members of the Jewish supernumerary police were well-known names like Lance Corporal Moshe Dayan, who really was quite a good Lance Corporal, and I suppose one should have been able to foretell that he was going to do quite well later on. And also, of course, what we didn't realize was that this organization of the Jewish supernumerary police really grew into the Palmach, which became eventually the Jewish army. And indeed, under the surface, I suppose you could say, the Jews were looking forward already to having an independent state there, and were, by using the guise of the Jewish supernumerary police, were training the leaders of their future army. Now, obviously, Wingate had got a great deal to do with this, and he was, by that time, I think, pretty well completely in their confidence. But I, as a very junior second lieutenant, knew nothing about this at all at the time, and I simply revelled in the feeling that here I was on a detached job with my own platoon, up to a point my own master, presided over by this extraordinary genius, Wingate, who we could all see was a was an unusual man. And he was a sort of human dynamo, not very strong, I would say, physically, but his mental abilities could keep him going far longer than perhaps we could. He had the advantage, of course, in speaking Arabic well. He'd spent 4 years, I think, in the Sudan Defense Force, and he learnt Hebrew, or enough Hebrew, in a remarkably short time, something like 6 weeks. There was no doubt about it that he had a remarkable brain on him. He could repeat large tracts of the Bible and Shakespeare and a few other things, and you always felt after he'd argued something that you agreed with him, and it was only sometime later that you could find any flaws in his arguments. But my soldiers didn't like him, I don't think, but they had enormous respect for him.
Why didn't they like him?
Well, because he kind of almost metaphorically looked over their heads. He wasn't going to get involved at all with the soldiers. He was looking at a far distant object, and they felt that we're sure that he's a brilliant man, but he doesn't take much notice of us. And the other thing I think that they didn't like about him, and nor did I for that matter, but I think he was probably right, is that he treated the Jewish supernumeraries fairly brutally. And if one of them was found talking or disobeying some order during the night, Wingate would have no hesitation in striking him in the face. And one of the first things after I saw this happen once was I said to Wingate, now look, sir, you're not going to do any of that sort of thing to any of my soldiers, because I said I wouldn't like to tell you what would happen if you did. And he was wise enough not to do it with British soldiers, but he did it with the Jews, and they appeared to sort of lap it up. I get a kind of feeling that they'd been told by the Jewish agency or whoever it was, I think they must have been told, now look, here is a chap who is a trained professional soldier. He is a dedicated Zionist, if you like it to put it that way. He is going to help us a great deal. He is a strange man, but he is going to do us a great deal of good. You'll have to go along with him, even if he does one, two things that you don't like. That's the impression that I got that must have been put over to the Jews. Indeed, I mean, possibly that was the only way of dealing with some of them, because they were, some of them were fairly rough types. They weren't all the sort of educated, cultured, civilized Jews. I mean, quite a few of them came from Russia, and they were, they needed fairly tough treatment, some of them. But, no, he was a remarkable chap. He didn't ask anybody to do anything that he wasn't prepared to do himself. And we would come in perhaps from 3 or 4 days out in the hills, marching hard all night and lying up in hidden places by day. And we'd all come back to Ayn Harod, and all most of us wanted was a good drink, a bath, and a lot of sleep. But he didn't. This dynamo which buzzed inside him kept him going. All he did was he'd eat a bunch of grapes, and he would then get hold of some maps, and with the information which he'd managed to arm himself of talking to Arabs and people in villages where we'd been around, he'd then rush off to Haifa, to brigade headquarters, or to some other Jewish settlement, and make plans for the next operation. And only when he'd finished that would he come back, and then he'd have to drop and sleep for 24 hours.
Did he seem to be a nervous man, or was he calm?
He was calm enough, but when he talked, there was a sort of slightly fanatic sound in when he was really getting on with an argument. He began to sound a little fanatical. Apart from that, I think you could say he was calm, but he had the sort of the fervor of a fanatic. And when he was expounding an argument, he wouldn't brook in any interference.
You mean as though he was in a pulpit or something?
As though he was in a pulpit, yes, and armed with the Ten Commandments or something like that. But I myself, I don't think I would have made a friend of him, but I couldn't help admiring the way he set about things, and this extraordinary energy that he'd got. And how he applied himself and sort of learnt Hebrew in literally about 6 weeks.
Did he have close friends, or was he isolated?
I never knew of any close friends. He had a wife, of course, as you know, who I think is still alive, as far as I know. I would not have thought he was a chap who would make close friends, no. He was too detached and too sort of full of burning ideas and idealism. I don't think he'd have had time for close friends.
In the night squads, how did the Jews and the British mix together?
Well, we mixed quite well, funnily enough. It's one of the only instances where I think the British and the Jews got to know each other. And they became on sort of Christian name terms, and the Jews obviously knew that they were going to learn a certain amount from us, and I suppose that was a good incentive. They would watch the way we did things, and indeed, during the daytime, when we went doing anything, we were giving them periods of instruction in weapon training and that sort of thing. I think they had a very high opinion of the British soldier. Somebody must have told them that he was a fairly professional chap. And I must say, my soldiers by this time, having been running around the hills for several months already with the battalion, they were fairly professional, and they knew how to do things. The one thing that they hadn't learned properly was this business of how to move at night. And this Wingett was very keen on, and he laid down certain rules, and the sort of thing which should be common sense, but people don't do it, is he said, right, now I'll show you how to manage your rifle when it's in the dark. This is an instructional period during the daytime. And he said, right, here is my rifle. I've got it standing up. It's in my hand, and the butt is on the ground. He said, how at night do you put it down? He said, I'll show you how most people put it down. They lower it halfway and let it drop the remainder of the way. He said, now I'll show you how it ought to be done. And he put it down as if the rifle was made of glass, and there wasn't a sound. And he said, that is how a rifle will always be put down at night when you're under my command. And this made a certain sort of an impact. And it was exactly the same. We normally certainly at certain stages in our patrols, we didn't talk. He taught us hand signals of tapping people on the shoulder. That two taps meant this and three taps meant that, and a short tap and a long tap meant something else. And also, and he used light signals. We had a torch which was very shaded and was on a, at the end of a long pole, which Wingate would carry, and he usually led the patrol. And the idea was that if you heard something, or if you were surprised and shot at, you would stretch the pole out either left or right, assuming that the enemy could probably see some sort of little light and would shoot at it, and therefore wouldn't hit the people because the pole would be stretched to a side. And according to the number of flashes you gave to backwards to the people behind you, meant whether the bulk of the patrol was to go round to the right or round to the left. And he arranged various simple signals like that so that you could deploy at night with the minimum noise, either by touch signals or with the use of this shaded torch.
What kind of touch signals?
Well, a touch on the shoulder would, depending on whether it was so many short or so many long ones, might mean go back and see whether the whole patrol is behind us. We're going to stop here. I mean, a simple one would mean stop. Another one would mean start. And so the whole thing was designed to stop people talking. And his idea was that the only person who was allowed to talk would be himself, and he would only do it in sort of dire circumstances. It's a fairly sort of dictatorial attitude, but in war, dictatorial attitudes work. But he evolved all this, and he made us practice these things, these ways, first of all in the daylight, and then as it was getting dark, and then finally at night, till we'd got it fairly perfected. And there wasn't any need to talk, there's no doubt about it. If you have a few simple signals, you don't. The fact of the matter is that the British soldier is an inveterate talker at night, and until somebody tells him you will not talk and teaches him some alternative methods of communication, he will talk. And this has been done later. I'm told that in Malaya, once the British battalions had learned, and in the war with the Japs in Burma, once the British battalions were really taught how to behave at night and not make a noise, they were just as good as the Japs or the Malays or anybody else. It's just that our national characteristics are noisy, and we've got to do something about them when in those circumstances.